Here are today's questions. And a quick summary, and then I'll get into the meat of them. The first one is about low reticulocytes or a low reticulocyte production index. Those are usually due to, or those are usually seen due to a low red blood cell production issue caused by a nutrient deficiency. You may or may not see an anemia come up if you're on the lower side of normal, but you know, not anemic. So what I would do is I would focus on nutrient-dense foods, specifically B12, folate, and iron, and not worry too much about it as long as you don't have any anemic symptoms. If you have anemic symptoms, but you're not showing anemia, but you have the low reticulocyte production index, then definitely something that I would dig a little bit deeper into. But start with nutrient density and see where that takes you. Okay, next question is about strategies for improving anxiety apart from exercise, sleep, meditation, and breathing. So to that list, I would add a nutrient-dense diet that's ancestrally appropriate, eating healthy fats and avoiding excessive PUFAs from, which are polyunsaturated fatty acids from industrial seed oils, spending time in nature, laughter. And there are a few supplements that could also help, although I would definitely always recommend the big rock kind of quadrant one and two items first before going to the interventions and quadrant three, like supplements. The next question is about great saphenous vein incompetence treatment, and that's usually some kind of thermal ablation or in very severe cases, vein ligation and stripping, but it is definitely something that can be treated. And last question is about what to do if you see elevated glucose in GGT on a blood chemistry, but all other markers are okay. So I would look at getting a continuous glucose monitor from somewhere like NutriSense to dig deeper into what your postprandial glucose is doing. I'm way more concerned with that than I am with your fasting glucose levels in the morning. But I would also look at sleep quality because cortisol in the morning, cortisol overnight could potentially be causing that. And I would consider some glutathione support for the elevated GGT. And I would try to find out why someone might have excessive oxidative stress leading them to need more glutathione in the first place. All right. So question one, I have a question and just also want to thank you for all the hard work you do. I've learned so much. Thank you for saying that. And I'm glad you're learning. So my question, the reticulocyte production index is low, about 0.6 with no anemia. What could possibly cause this and how can I increase it? Okay, so some background on reticulocytes. Reticulocytes are immature red blood cells that usually are matured within 1 to 2 days, and they're released from the bone marrow into the peripheral circulation. And I want to confirm here that the reticulocyte production index is low at 0.6 because usually 0.6 is a number that looks more like a total reticulocyte count to me. But it could also be the RPI. So just I want to make sure that we are talking about the RPI versus reticulocytes because that does or it can make some difference. So usually reticulocytes are low or the reticulocyte production index is low, and the reticulocyte production index is a corrected count using hematocrit and a correction factor. So usually those are low in the context of anemias that are due to a red blood cell production issue. So it's not typically a destruction or a loss, it's a red blood cell production issue. And that most often occurs because of a nutrient deficiency or deficiencies. Medications can also cause low reticulocyte counts, and there are some very rare causes of nutrient deficiencies. Rare causes of the low reticulocytes, but nutrient deficiencies are by far the most common. And it's possible that even if anemia is not present, reticulocytes or the low RPI could be due to a nutrient deficiency still. So I would run an experiment where you load up on nutrients that are needed for red blood cell production. So specifically iron, B12, and folate. And it could also be, and then retest reticulocytes in, you know, I have 2-3 months, that kind of thing. And it could also be that you just run a little bit lower on reticulocytes. So if you're already eating a nutrient-dense diet, if you're eating enough of those nutrient-dense foods, if you're not anemic and you're also not experiencing symptoms of anemia like fatigue, then it's very possible that this might be non-pathological. All right. Question two, beyond the most more obvious strategies of good sleep, exercise, meditation, and breathing, are there any teas or natural compounds that are good for anxiety? Okay, so I would always start with quadrant one interventions here, followed by quadrant two, then three, then four. So sleep, exercise, movement, meditation, breathing, all of those things are excellent ways to help with anxiety and minimize environmental mismatch. Along with good quality and quantity of sleep, I would include more generally supporting your circadian rhythm. So that means getting outside in the morning, even on a cloudy day, avoiding blue light at night, eating when the sun is up, and also exercising at an appropriate time of day, things like that. I would also include good nutrition on that list, which means nutrient-dense whole foods, being mindful of the quality and the quantity of carbohydrates that you're consuming, and avoiding large glucose fluctuations throughout the day is also important for anxiety. And on the nutrition front, I would also avoid excessive amounts of polyunsaturated fatty acids coming from industrial seed oils. In fact, I would just get the industrial seed oils like canola, corn, sunflower, safflower out of your diet altogether. They don't need to be there. And I would focus on eating fatty fish multiple times a week for the omega-3s. If the fatty fish isn't going to happen, things like salmon, sardines, anchovies, herring, mackerel, then a good quality DHA, good quality fish oil that's high in DHA would be an appropriate alternative. Chris and Simon recently talked about the physiological sigh, which can help switch the nervous system to more of a parasympathetic state, and therefore may help with things like stress and anxiety. So I would look into that. Spending time in nature, I would recommend at least weekly, if possible, along with getting sunshine on your skin to synthesize natural vitamin D will be helpful for anxiety. Laughter and humor have also been shown to effectively relieve depression, anxiety, and also, interestingly, improve sleep quality. So I would try to get some of that in your life. And for people with social anxiety disorder, commitment to a purpose in life has been shown to provide a boost in well-being. And regardless of any tendency toward anxiety, I think that purpose is a very important and often overlooked aspect of health. There is some evidence that L-theanine, which is found in small amounts in tea, especially high-quality matcha green tea, can be helpful for anxiety. 200 to 400 milligrams of L-theanine seems to be the sweet spot. And high doses of caffeine can definitely be an anxiety trigger for some people. One way around that is to limit caffeine consumption, but you can also take L-theanine in a 2-to-1 ratio with caffeine to help with some of the jittery, anxious feeling that some people get with coffee. And while we're talking about tea, there is some evidence that chamomile may help due to its calming effects. Sorry, my puppy is trying to get at the floor vent over here. I don't know why. So there's also some suggestion that chronic EMF exposure may negatively impact anxiety levels as well as depression, stress, and sleep quality. So putting your phone on airplane mode when it can be on airplane mode, especially at night, avoiding putting your phone near your head, turning the Wi-Fi off at night, hardwiring your computer if possible. I would definitely recommend all of those interventions. You can get into a lot of fringe interventions for EMF mitigation, but I think that the big rock items are probably the most impactful there. And then there are some supplements that might be helpful. Again, to reiterate, these would not be my first lines of defense for tackling anxiety, and studies have mixed results. And some supplements seem to have better evidence than others, but those would include ashwagandha, CBD oil, L-lysine with L-arginine, magnesium, taurine, glycine, and also valerian root. Excuse me for 1 second. I need to give Cooper something to chew on. Okay, we're back. Question three. See the post here on the forum. Wondering if anyone has any experience with great saphenous vein incompetence. I have a client who has this, and it sounds like the proposed solution is to shut down the veins. I was wondering if anyone knows if this is a pretty standard solution to the problem, or if there are other options others have explored. I know nothing at all about this, so just looking for some resources. Okay, so I'll preface my answer here that I don't have any clinical experience with this. That said, great saphenous vein insufficiency occurs when the great saphenous vein and valves of it don't function as they should. So the great saphenous vein runs from the groin to the ankle, and with insufficiency, blood moves backward rather than upward toward the heart. This causes the veins to ultimately bulge out and become varicose veins often. I'm pretty sure that we covered varicose veins before during office hours, so I'll have a link to that session. And the standard of care for this kind of thing seems to be some kind of thermal ablation or vein ligation and stripping. The thermal ablation options are minimally invasive, and that's where the damaged varicose veins are basically sealed off and blood is rerouted through healthier veins. Vein ligation and stripping involve surgery, where the damaged part of the vein is removed, usually when there are large varicose veins that are causing a lot of discomfort. So it seems like thermal ablation options are definitely the first line of defense due to their non-invasiveness, and then surgery is saved for more severe cases. But it is definitely a treatable thing with some level of procedure. All right, last question. What is your recommendation if glucose and GGT are high and all the other markers seem to be normal? So for fasting glucose, I would look at how this person is sleeping to see if their elevated number could potentially be related to cortisol levels. You could also have them prick their finger when they wake up in the morning for, 4 or 5 days to see if the elevated fasting glucose was just a one-time thing and not their norm. But in general, I'm much more concerned with your postprandial or after meal glucose variability than I am with your fasting levels. So using a continuous glucose monitor, you can rent them from places like NutriSense or Levels to look at glucose variability over the course of the day would be my recommendation if you're at all concerned with any kind of glucose dysregulation. For the GGT, I would consider some glutathione support. So you could go the N-acetylcysteine route, which is the precursor to glutathione. You could use reduced glutathione, or you could also use liposomal glutathione if you want to bring out the big guns. My big question would be, why is this person needing glutathione support in the first place? So where is the excessive oxidative stress coming from? If glucose dysregulation turned out to be a real thing, then using a continuous glucose monitor, then the oxidative stress could potentially be related to that. But there are many other places that excessive oxidative stress could be coming from, including the gut, environmental toxins, diet, lack of quality sleep, things like that. And Chris and I actually recorded a podcast on oxidative stress a while back. So we'll make sure to include that in the show notes for people who are interested. But I have had pretty good results with bringing GGT down with something like N-acetylcysteine. All right. So those are the questions for today. Right now, I'll open the floor to see if anyone else has follow-ups to these or totally unrelated questions.
Hey, Megan. This is Nick. You mentioned timing of training as a element of anxiety reduction in some way, shape, or form. I've never read anything detailed about training timing. I'm assuming, though, that the main guidance is to avoid late evening, right before bed,
yep.
Right?
Yep. Yeah. So that was in relation to your circadian rhythm. So if you're doing a really intense exercise or training session at 6, 7, 8 p.m. at night, that can definitely mess with circadian rhythm, which can therefore, feedback into things like anxiety, stress, depression, that kind of thing. The big recommendation there is to exercise at an appropriate time of day, which is largely like when the sun is out.
Any on that topic, you know, there's lots of ways to monitor and measure this stuff these days that we didn't have even 3 or 4 years ago. So, you know, I keep an eye on my body battery, right? Which is basically Garmin's use of HRV to tell you something about parasympathetic versus sympathetic, et cetera. Yeah. Is there any evidence to suggest that one can actually assess any negative impact of training maybe too late in the day based on how your body battery recovers or anything else that you measure on that front?
So I don't know of any like direct studies. Potentially, I would say yes, especially if the late in the day training is causing a significant cortisol spike. Your cortisol is supposed to spike in the morning, slowly drop down during the day, and be the lowest in night, lowest overnight, and then it does the same thing in the morning. It spikes up back up again. So if the training is artificially increasing cortisol levels, especially if there's pre-training caffeine involved, then that's definitely going to mess with your HRV. Could also mess with just sleep quality in general, also resting heart rate. Resting heart rate, as in resting heart rate over the course of the night, could also be a little bit elevated. So there's a lot of things there that could be impacted, whether we're talking about subjective sleep or, you know, this body battery measurement, or if you're looking at the Oura Ring measurements on there. Body temperature is another thing. You know, if you're increasing your core body temperature and your overall body temperature by training late at night, then one of the best ways to tell your body it's time to go to sleep is a drop in core body temperature. So that can also shift things around negatively as well.
Got it. Punchline, train before dinner, right? Yeah. Eat as early as you can, blah, blah, blah. Okay, I get it. I get it. Thank you.
Of course.
Hi, Megan.
Hi, Stuart.
Sorry, I'm doing multitasking, so it took me a minute to get to my mic.
No worries.
You had one question about anxiety. You gave a bunch of different things on anxiety, and one of them had to do with meditation. Mm-hmm. And I worked with a counselor that I use for anxiety. Now it's been years ago because I haven't really had very much in the last 5 or 6 years. I had a number of stressful things going on in my life that were obviously or potentially the triggers. And what the counselor and I figured out for me anyways, and this is just to give an example of one person's experience dealing with anxiety, was that there was some triggers that were, in my case, they had to do with making decisions. Like I couldn't figure out how to make decisions. A lot of that was creating the anxiety. In the end, I did a meditative technique where I just chose a mantra that was a single word that I thought represented sort of a way out. And so if I don't, you know, this may not be related to the question somebody asked, but if somebody's having anxiety that they can sort of pinpoint what's driving it and it's not physical, it's, you know, the results are physical, but the driver isn't physical. It's more mental. In my case, it was just, I had a mantra I used when I meditated. It was, there must be a simple solution, or I ended up just using the single word simple. Mm-hmm. And it was incredibly effective.
Wow.
I was really blown away by how effective it was just to sort of give my brain this suggestion that it was struggling with something that really wasn't that hard.
I like that. Thanks for sharing. Decision-making processes can be anxiety provoking, definitely. So I really like that.
Yeah, it was really neat. And then sort of, I don't know if you want me to go into this or if anybody else wants to have a moment to ask questions, but I had a couple comments about my own progress.
Sure.
So I've been playing with and upping the amount of fiber, mostly acacia fiber, because it's really easy to drink extra of without it being a big glob of jello. And I definitely see an improvement in terms of, you know, essentially probably the biggest improvement is the reducing the urgency to go to the bathroom or the need to go multiple times a day, more times. But it doesn't seem to really, so far I wouldn't consider it to be like a solution. It isn't like, oh, that was a panacea. It's more like a Band-Aid is what it feels like, if that makes sense.
Yeah.
I still have loose stools. They just aren't as loose. And I don't have as much of the mucus that I was describing or really, unless I eat something wrong. So, and I guess I was just trying to figure out, you had suggested that the next thing to do was an organic acids test, or suggesting that that is next possibility.
Yeah, I would consider it just to look at the amount of yeast, potentially yeast overgrowth in your gut.
Okay.
Because that could certainly be contributing to your symptoms. And I'm guessing that the acacia fiber is helping by largely slowing transit time, especially in your colon. So your colon's able to now, you know, it absorbs water from your stool. Therefore, things aren't as urgent. Things are maybe a little bit more formed, less mucus. That makes sense to me. But I do agree that, you know, if you're having to take a massive amount of acacia fiber just to be a little bit better, that is more of a Band-Aid approach. So I think digging in and trying to, again, get to the root cause by doing some testing could be beneficial. Now, if we wanted to, we could try some, you know, an empirical round of natural antifungals rather than testing, but it would probably be good to see if Candida or something like that is at play.
Okay. Yeah, I think that's probably my next move. Okay. I think I'm up to pretty much 3 tablespoons of acacia fiber, which I think is about 18 grams of fiber.
Okay. That's a pretty hefty dose.
It's a pretty hefty dose. Yeah, it seems like it. And the benefits are significant. I mean, in terms of symptoms, but it doesn't, like, I don't know. I mean, if I eat foods that I consider to be the ones that trigger things, I still end up with problems that are worse. You know, it's sort of like you took the whole experience and shifted it to the better direction. But if you put in foods that create a problem, they still create a problem. It just isn't quite as bad.
Okay.
So yeah, that was kind of my interpretation too. Yeah. Cool. I think that's it for me today.
Okay.
Thanks, Megan. Right.
Yeah. Thanks, Stuart.
Bye-bye.
Bye. I'll hang out a couple more minutes if anyone else has anything.
Hey, Megan, probably not. So this is Nick again, while you have a few minutes. So, hey, I'll figure out with the different tools available how to more thoroughly document symptoms, right? Things that are puzzling, whatever you want to call them, right? All the observations I've made over the last few years and more recently that I don't have good explanations for. But one of them that's more top of mind, I think, for our near-term discussions is around, I have this feeling based on a host of different indications that something's amiss that relates to blood flow, availability of healing factors in my extremities.
Okay.
You know, I had a physical therapist say that he thought he saw early indications of some pitting edema, right? Any foot, leg, ankle injury takes forever, like literally 3-4 times longer than it used to take to heal. You know, hair on my lower legs, right, is not growing back anymore. If I injure the skin on my ankles or feet, I had swimmer's itch this past summer, right? It took 5 months, right, for the ensuing sores to like fade to the point where they're only scars now. Yeah. And they were actively like sores for weeks. And none of that used to be the case, right? And this is another one of those situations where you talk to old people and they say, oh, that's just getting older. It's bullshit, right? I don't believe it. There's got to be something else, right?
Yeah.
Anyways, I don't have time to have an answer, to listen to a full answer now. I have to jump to a meeting in 4 minutes.
Okay.
But I'd be very keen at least to get your top of mind thinking, right, around possible route, some hypotheses around directions I could go to better understand. And obviously in our first meeting, it's something I want to incorporate into kind of our root cause hypothesis generation around hunting, right?
Yeah.
Hunting grounds for us. So any top of mind, I think I covered the main things. Oh, and then the last one is like get up in the morning and literally it can take minutes to hours for my lower legs to be able to move properly. Like, joints are stiff, ankles are stiff. If I get up in the middle of the night, like walking, you know, there's been nights where I've dreaded walking to go to the bathroom because they just don't move. It's like it's dry, right? The myofascia is tight, etc. And again, that's independent of how much I'm training. It's worse if I'm training a lot, right? But even when I was in a heavy recovery mode, you know, less than 3-4 hours of training a week, it was even worse before I got a structural integrator working on me every 2 weeks, combined with joint support supplements, right, which are in my list. Anyways, I don't know what I don't know, right? But it's all adding up to this dynamic around something not flowing correctly or being available in my extremities.
Right. Okay. One question for you. I know you have to go. Do you have any, like, do your feet, hands get super cold? Like more so than others?
You know, my wife complains about cold hands a lot.
Your cold hands, not her cold hands.
My okay. Cold hands.
Okay.
Sorry. I mean, I don't notice so much, but, but yeah, there's an element to that.
Okay. So her hands could be warm. Your hands could be much cooler than hers. Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. Okay. That might give me a little bit more of a clue as to what could be going on.
Okay. But I'm going to jump. I just wanted to share that as food
thank
for
you.
Thought. And look, I'll submit it for the next office hours because it may be of interest to others and we can use this time if there's no other pressing topics for other folks.
Yeah. Perfect. Thanks,
cool.
Nick.
Have a good week.
Okay. You too.
Hi, Megan. This is Kim.
Hi, Kim. How are you?
Good. Tommy said he submitted a question, but I don't think you received it. I think he might have submitted in the wrong place because Chris actually responded to him with an article. I don't know. The question was related to thyroid, autoimmune disease, and H. pylori. Should we just submit it next week or do you know anything off the top of your head?
Yeah. So, I know for a fact that gut infections like H. pylori or like other things can be, you know, there's usually we as in the scientists, people like Alessio Fasano, who's a big gluten guy and zonulin guy, they say that there are three aspects to autoimmune conditions. One is a leaky gut or intestinal permeability. One is some kind of trigger. And that trigger can be an environmental toxin. It could be a stressful event. It could be a gut infection. It could be a viral infection, any kind of trigger. And then the third component is typically some kind of genetic predisposition. So yes, absolutely. That trigger for some people could be something like H. pylori. Even if the infection wasn't the original trigger. And, you know, there can also be a confluence or multiple triggers. Sometimes something like H. pylori in the gut or different kind of infection can impede progress as far as like an autoimmune thyroid condition is concerned, getting better from that. So I don't know if that answers your question, but that's kind of a high level overview of how H. pylori and something like Hashimoto's autoimmune conditions are related. But I can absolutely go into more detail if you guys have any specific questions as far as like what to do, et cetera. Obviously, what to do would be try to address the issue, which could potentially be H. pylori. But if any other questions you have, I'm more than happy to dig a little bit deeper.
And so do you recommend to like use thyroid medicine as you're treating H. pylori?
So it depends on the case. It depends on the person. It depends on how miserable you are. I'm not opposed to thyroid medication at all. I think it can be life-changing, like extraordinarily life-changing for some people. So I'm absolutely not opposed to it. You know, sometimes with Hashimoto's, Graves, there needs to be long-term medication, and that's okay. That doesn't mean that you should just leave something like an infection, assuming it's, you know, a more pathogenic type of H. pylori, just hanging around. But no, I think that as far as the medication goes, that should be determined on a case-to-case basis, depending on the person, depending on their symptoms, how long things have been going on, how bad things are, that kind of thing. But right. I'm not opposed at all.
Okay. Thank you.
Yeah, you're welcome. And again, Kim, if there's anything else you guys want answered, you can submit the question to office hours. Tommy can. I'm more than happy to dive deeper if there are more specifics.
Okay. Yeah, I think he got confused and submitted it to two different places. I'm not sure what happened, but we'll try again for next week.
Too. Okay. Yeah. No worries. I'm happy to dive in deeper and to cover more.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
I'm coming back for another question.
Okay, great.
Try and make it quick. So when I brought up the condition with using fiber, and you said it could slow down the speed or the transit time, mm-hmm. Are there any other things besides some kind of overgrowth that affect transit time? Because that's definitely one of the practitioners that I'm really missing in my life. I think I've mentioned to you before as a bodywork guy that I worked with, who just seemed to know, he just studied a lot of stuff. His license was licensed massage therapist, but that wasn't really what he did anymore. and he had mentioned that he thought that possibly my issue was related to an ileocecal valve that didn't do its job properly.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So that is one thing that could potentially be going on. There's a lot of talk about that and not a ton of literature about it. So it's a good theory and mechanistically it makes sense. But again, like the question is, well, why is it not working correctly?
Right.
You know, so.
That's kind of, I was thinking, do I ask this question or not? Because I think I kind of know what she's going to answer, but I guess I'll ask it anyways.
Yeah. Yeah. And it's one of those things where you'll hear a lot of people in the gut health space talk about like issues with valves, especially the ileocecal valve. Again, mechanistically, it all makes sense, but there's unfortunately not a ton of research to support, well, like, is this really going on? And then what interventions do you do to help the ileocecal valve function correctly?
Right.
You know, structural things could be going on that affects it. Certainly microbial overgrowth or changes in the gut ecosystem could affect it. I don't know. I would assume that things like stress could also affect it in the long term, but I don't know if there's things, you know, like we know that, for example, one of the hypotheses for small intestinal bacterial overgrowth is that after about a food poisoning, there can be like an autoimmune attack that occurs on the migrating motor complex. It helps, it's like the complex that helps move things from your mouth all the way down. And I don't know if there's anything like that as far as like creating antibodies to certain proteins in that valve or something like that. I don't know. Again, I'm hypothesizing, but
right. Yeah, no, I get it.
So yeah, I long or short answer is I'm not 100% sure.
Yeah.
But I'll look at it and see if there's anything else that could be, you know, certainly, caffeine will affect transit time, things that I know probably aren't an issue for you. You know, exercise can certainly mess with transit time in both the small and the large intestine. So it seems to, more with the small intestine, slow transit time and increase transit time in the large intestine, which can cause, like in a lot of runners, we see runner's diarrhea. I don't necessarily think that's the case for you though.
No, I mean, generally, I think if my system's not working right, I just have the issue of, you know, if I'm exercising, it's like, oh, do I need to stop and go to the bathroom? If I'm exercising for several, you know, if I'm skiing for several hours.
Yeah.
Like I got to do yesterday in the middle of a snowstorm that dumped 17 inches.
Oh my gosh. Oh, how fun.
Yeah. It snowed 12 inches overnight and it snowed six more or five more while we were skiing yesterday. So.
Wow.
So it was awesome. And that totally on a personal note, my partner who's skiing has gone through the roof this year in terms of her ability. We demoed her some skis that were more appropriate for those conditions yesterday. And she's still grinning this morning.
Oh, how fun.
She's like, I got to have a pair of those skis.
Well, it's a good Christmas gift.
Yeah, exactly. So anyways, yeah, no, that's all interesting. And I'm very much in sort of the same camp. It's like, well, if that valve isn't working right, what's going on? It's kind of like acid reflux disease. It's like, well, acid reflux disease seems to be as much a problem with the valve at the top of your stomach as it is with the acid that gets into your esophagus. That's the symptom, right? But that's not the cause.
Yep. Yeah. And there's a weak lower esophageal sphincter or one that's not working properly. But again, the question is why it doesn't happen like that.
Yeah. Not being triggered to stay closed at the appropriate times was one of the theories that I'd heard, or one of the persons working house that I'd heard. So yeah. Okay, cool. I appreciate that. And you had mentioned with the organic acid test that there were sort of two versions. There would be one where we could just look for candida overgrowth or things like that, and one that would show more information, and the difference was about $100. What is the more information? Can you give me an idea?
Sure. The more information, they look at the other markers, look at some level of mitochondrial function, glutathione status, detoxification, and the methylation abilities, your B vitamin markers, so B12, folate, B6. That's largely some neurotransmitters, but honestly, I'm not super excited about neurotransmitters that show up in the urine. We don't necessarily have any evidence to suggest that they correlate with brain neurotransmitters. And typically if someone's gut is off, because most of those neurotransmitters are made in the gut, then those neurotransmitters are going to be off anyway. So the neurotransmitters I don't care so much about, but the other stuff can sometimes be kind of interesting. But it's up to you.
For me, I think it would be interesting to see what what your indicators for mitochondrial function say for me. Mm-hmm. I would think my mitochondrial function is, especially right now, after the amount of type of exercise that I'm doing for the last 3-4 months and things, would be getting better, not worse. And I sort of feel that way. You know, I mean, if you take my gut issues away, other than the now sort of the occasional evening when I'm just wiped out, I think I'm doing pretty good other than the gut issues.
That's great. And if you want to check up on those, and I've said this before and I'll say it again, there's no perfect test for mitochondrial function. It's interesting to look at the organic acids, and they can give us some insight into it. So if you wanted to spend the extra $100 and get those extra markers, I'm certainly not opposed, but.
Yeah, and the B vitamins, I'd be really curious. I mean, the way I eat, I would think I'm getting plenty of B vitamins, but I would really be curious to see what it looks like on the other side of it. Like, am I really absorbing what I'm eating?
Yeah, absolutely. And folate, you know, if you're depending on your vegetable consumption, if you're avoiding leafy greens for gut issues, then looking at folate could be interesting too.
Yeah, cool. To schedule that, I should just get a hold of Tammy or something.
Yeah, I'll actually, do you know for sure you want to do it?
Yeah, I want to do it.
Okay. Then I'll have her
go ahead and do it.
Okay. I'll have her reach out over Trello and she'll send you the kit. Make sure you read the instructions, because there are a couple things. I don't think you're eating them, but a handful of things that you can't eat in the 24 to 48 hours before the test. And you may have to do a little bit of fluid restriction. I don't recall for the organic acids. But otherwise it's a pretty straightforward test.
Okay. When it says fluid restrictions, how restricted is that?
So I think it's like, you know, starting 6 p.m. the night before, you don't drink it. You limit your water. You know, you're not chugging a liter of water before you go to bed, that kind of thing.
Yeah. So I might have to just move up my evening routine that involves my glass of fiber till before 6 p.m. or whatever.
Yeah. Yeah. And I don't even know for sure that the organic acid test makes you restrict water. I know the mycotoxin test does. It's the serum. Okay. But I don't remember.
I'll be sure to read the instructions.
Okay. Great.
I'm usually pretty good about that sort of thing.
Good.
All right. I'm going to do something new. This is going to be the first time this year I'm skiing 2 days back to back. So I'm going up skiing this afternoon.
Oh, nice. Have fun.
I don't know how well my body's going to do it, but I have a friend who haven't skied with ever before and really want to go skiing with him. And he texted me last night and he goes, I'm going to go tomorrow. And I said, oh, damn. Okay, I'll go.
The snow will still be good. Yes.
Well, we're going to go someplace lower. So unfortunately, it's going to be a little bit on the softer, heavy side. I don't know what it's going to be like, but we'll deal with that. I'm sure it'll still be fun. He's way more familiar with the place we're going than I am. And the place I normally go, he doesn't think it's difficult enough. So, or something. I can't always tell. And it's not. It's really a lot of intermediate slopes at Timberline. And a lot of people don't ski there for that reason, but I ski there because it's cheap and I can get a lot of runs in.
There's something to be said for that.
Yeah, and that could change. And my partner, you know, at the beginning of the year, she wouldn't have wanted to ski to anything more difficult. But it's at this point, she is actually, you know, we get to the bottom of the run and that was fun, but it'd be nice if it was a little steeper. And she goes, oh yeah, I agree with that. You know, it's like, okay, well, we have to start searching things out. And if it weren't for COVID, we would probably both fly to Salt Lake City and go skiing for 6 days because she's got a spot coming up in April. So, but she already got a vaccine, but I am still waiting. And I really, even though there's a part of me that agrees with you that we don't know what an mRNA vaccine looks like in the long run, I don't think I can afford not to try it.
I don't want to get into the vaccine talk, but it's, there's certainly I'm glad we have them. And there's more coming into the pipeline too.
There's
mRNA release.
Yeah, but when the state decides that I can get one, I won't probably have a choice on which one I get.
Yeah. So. Nope, that's true. You gotta take what you can get.
Yep. Okay. Thanks.
All right. You're welcome, sir. Have fun skiing.
Yep. Okay. Thanks. Thank you. Bye-bye.
Bye.